Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Greeley Tribune, read by Elisa Burrows. This is being recorded on Wednesday, January 7th, 2026. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Removal of Maduro. What is the plan for, quote, running Venezuela, unquote? January 6, 2021 attack. Fifth anniversary brings fresh division to the capital. Property taxes. Changes have saved homeowners nearly $1 billion. Catalyst. Study says project could drive $2.9 billion in economic activity. And we will be following up with miscellaneous articles. We'll start on today's front page with the first main article. Removal of Maduro. What is the plan for, quote, running Venezuela, unquote? Written by Matthew Lee of the Associated Press. There is a photo accompanying this article. The caption reads, Secretary of State Marco Rubio arrives at the U.S. Capitol on Monday for a closed-door briefing with top lawmakers. The photo pictures Secretary Rubio in a navy blue suit, white shirt, and red tie, walking down a set of stairs, followed by a male staffer. Here is the article. President Donald Trump has made broad but vague assertions that the United States is going to quote-unquote run Venezuela after the ouster of Nicolas Maduro, but has offered almost no details about how it will do so, raising questions among some lawmakers and former officials about the administration's level of planning for the country after Maduro was gone. Seemingly contradictory statements from Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio have suggested at once that the U.S. now controls the levers of Venezuelan power, or that the U.S. has no intention of assuming day-to-day governance and will allow Maduro's subordinates to remain in leadership positions for now. Rubio said the U.S. would rely on existing sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector and criminal gangs to wield leverage with Maduro's successors. The uncertainty on definitive next steps in Venezuela contrasts with the years of discussions and planning that went into U.S. military interventions that deposed other autocratic leaders, notably in Iraq in 2003, which still did not often lead to the hoped-for outcomes. The discrepancy between what Trump and Rubio have said publicly has not sat well with some former diplomats. Quote, It strikes me that we have no idea whatsoever as to what's next, said Dan Fried, a retired career diplomat, former Assistant Secretary of State, and sanctions coordinator, who served under both Democratic and Republican administrations. Quote, For good operational reasons, there were very few people who knew about the raid, but Trump's remarks about running the country and Rubio's uncomfortable walk back suggest that even within that small group of people, there is disagreement about how to proceed, said Fried, who is now with the Atlantic Council think tank. Supporters of the operation, meanwhile, believe there is little confusion over the U.S. goal. Quote, The president speaks in big headlines and euphemisms, said Rich Goldberg, a sanctions proponent who worked in the National Energy Dominance Council at the White House until last year and is now a senior advisor to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a hawkish think tank. Goldberg does not see Rubio becoming, quote, the superintendent of schools, unquote, but, quote, effectively, the U.S. will be calling the shots, unquote. Quote, There are people at the top who can make what we want happen or not, and we right now control their purse strings and their lives, he said. The president thinks it's enough, and the secretary thinks it's enough, and if it's not enough, we'll know very soon and we'll deal with it, unquote. If planning for the U.S. to run Venezuela existed prior to Maduro's arrest and extradition to face federal drug charges, it was confined to a small group of Trump political allies, according to current U.S. officials, who note that Trump relies on a very small circle of advisors and has tossed aside much of the traditional decision-making apparatus. These officials, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss their understanding of internal deliberations, said they were not aware of any preparations for either a military occupation or an interim civilian governing authority, which has been a priority for previous administrations when they contemplated going to war to oust a specific leader or government. The White House and the State Department press office did not return messages seeking comment. Previous military actions that deposed autocratic leaders, notably in Panama in 1989 and Iraq in 2003, were preceded by months, if not years, of interagency discussion and debate over how best to deal with power vacuums caused by the ousters of their leaders. The State Department, White House National Security Council, the Pentagon, and the intelligence community all participated in that planning. In Panama, the George H.W. Bush administration had nearly a full year of preparations to launch the invasion that ousted Panama's leader, Manuel Noriega. Panama, however, is exponentially smaller than Venezuela. It had long experience as a de facto American territory, and the U.S. occupation was never intended to retake territory or natural resources. By contrast, Venezuela is vastly larger in size and population and has a decades-long history of animosity toward the United States. Quote, Panama was not successful because it was supported internationally, because it wasn't, Fried said. It was a success because it led to a quick, smooth transfer to a democratic government. That would be a success here, but on the first day out, we trashed someone who had those credentials, and that struck me as daft, unquote. He was referring to Trump's apparent dismissal of opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, whose party is widely believed to have won elections in 2024, results that Maduro refused to accept. Trump said Saturday that Machado, quote, doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country, unquote, to be a credible leader, and suggested he would be okay with Maduro's number two, Delcy Rodriguez, remaining in power as long as she works with the U.S. Meanwhile, best-case scenarios like those predicted by the George W. Bush administration for a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq, that it would be a beacon of democracy in the Middle East, and hopes for a democratic and stable Afghanistan following the ouster of the Taliban, died painfully slow deaths at the tremendous expense of American money and lives after initial euphoria over military victories. Quote, Venezuela looks nothing like Libya, it looks nothing like Iraq, it looks nothing like Afghanistan, it looks nothing like the Middle East, Rubio said this weekend of Venezuela and its neighbors. These are Western countries with long traditions at a people-to-people and cultural level and ties to the United States, so it's nothing like that, unquote. The lack of clarity on Venezuela has been even more pronounced because Trump campaigned on a platform of extricating the U.S. from foreign wars and entanglements, a position backed by his Make America Great Again supporters, many of whom are seeking explanations about what the president has in mind for Venezuela. Quote, Wake up, MAGA, Republican Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, who has bucked much of his party's lockstep agreement with Trump, posted on X after the operation. Our next main article, January 6, 2021 attack. Fifth anniversary brings fresh division to the Capitol. Written by Lisa Moscaro of the Associated Press. 5 years ago, outside the White House, outgoing President Donald Trump told a crowd of supporters to head to the Capitol, quote, and I'll be there with you, unquote, in protest as Congress was affirming the 2020 election victory for Democrat Joe Biden. A short time later, the world watched as the seat of U.S. power descended into chaos and democracy hung in the balance. On the fifth anniversary of January 6, 2021, there was no official event to memorialize what happened that day when the mob made its way down Pennsylvania Avenue, battled police at the Capitol barricades, and stormed inside as lawmakers fled. The political parties refused to agree to a shared history of the events, which were broadcast around the globe. And the official plaque honoring the police who defended the Capitol has never been hung. Instead, the day displayed the divisions that still define Washington and the country, and the White House itself issued a glossy new report with its own revised history of what happened. Trump, during a lengthy morning speech to House Republicans, convening away from the Capitol at the rebranded Kennedy Center, now carrying his own name, shifted blame for January 6th onto the rioters themselves. The president said he had intended only for his supporters to go, quote, peacefully and patriotically, unquote, to confront Congress as it certified Biden's win. He blamed the media for focusing on other parts of his speech that day. At the same time, Democrats held their own morning meeting at the Capitol, reconvening members of the House committee that investigated the January 6, 2021 attack for a panel discussion. Recalling the history of the day is important, they said, in order to prevent what Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, warned was the GOP's, quote, Orwellian project of forgetting, unquote. And the former leader of the militant Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, summoned people for a midday march retracing the rioters' steps from the White House to the Capitol, this time to honor Trump supporter Ashley Babbitt and others who died in the January 6 siege and its aftermath. More than 100 people gathered, including Babbitt's mother. Tarrio and others are putting pressure on the Trump administration to punish officials who investigated and prosecuted the January 6 rioters. He was sentenced to 22 years in prison for seditious conspiracy for orchestrating the January 6th attack, and he is among more than 1,500 defendants who saw their charges dropped when Trump issued a sweeping pardon on his return to the White House last year. Quote, they should be fired and prosecuted, Tarrio told the crowd before they arrived at the Capitol, confronted along the way by counter-protesters, and sang the national anthem. The White House, in its new report, highlighted the work the president has already done to free those charged and turned the blame on Democrats for certifying Biden's election victory. This milestone anniversary carries echoes of the differences that erupted that day, but it unfolds while attention is focused elsewhere, particularly after the U.S. military's stunning capture of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, and Trump's plans to take over the country and prop up its vast oil industry, a striking new era of American expansionism. Quote, these people in the administration, they want to lecture the world about democracy when they're undermining the rule of law at home, as we all will be powerfully reminded, House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York said on the eve of the anniversary. House Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana, responding to requests for comment about the delay in hanging the plaque honoring the police at the Capitol, as required by law, said in a statement on the eve of the anniversary that the statute, quote, is not implementable, unquote, and proposed alternatives, quote, also do not comply with the statute, unquote. At the morning hearing at the Capitol, lawmakers heard from a range of witnesses and others, including former U.S. Capitol Police officer Winston Pinjin, who said as a kid he always dreamed of being a cop. But on that day, he thought he was going to die in the mayhem on the steps of the Capitol. Quote, I implore America to not forget what happened, he said. I believe the vast majority of Americans have so much more in common than what separates us, unquote. Also testifying was Pamela Hemphill, a rioter who refused Trump's pardon, blamed the president for the violence, and silenced the room as she apologized to the officer sitting alongside her at the witness table, stifling tears. Quote, I can't allow them to not be recognized, to be lied about, Hemphill said about the police, who she said also saved her life as she fell and was trampled on by the mob. Until I can see that plaque get up there, I'm not done, unquote. Among those testifying were former Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who, along with former Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, were the two Republicans on the panel that investigated Trump's efforts to overturn Biden's win. Continuing on today's front page, we have our third main article, Property Taxes. Changes have saved homeowners nearly $1 billion. Written by Nick Coltrane of the Denver Post. Colorado homeowners' total savings from a spate of property tax changes in recent years are expected to eclipse $1 billion soon, money that has and will stay in owners' pockets, but with an effect on local services that is still being tallied. To backers of the cuts, the savings reflect state efforts to blunt Colorado's affordability crisis, especially as home valuations and corresponding tax bills skyrocketed following the pandemic. For service providers that rely on local taxes, such as libraries, fire departments, and river conservation agencies, the savings have meant a cloud over their budgets as they grapple to meet higher demands. In other words, the property tax wars may have ceased, but the dust still hasn't settled. Quote, districts are trying to figure out how to provide ongoing services and perhaps additional services their communities need with less or potentially less, said Ann Terry, the CEO of the Special District Association of Colorado, as her members were still finalizing their budgets in December. By no means were districts sitting on piles of cash, unquote. There are thousands of entities across the state that receive property taxes, including school districts, cities, and county governments. Property taxes pay for more than 24 types of local improvement and service districts that cover cemeteries, ambulances, pest control, flood prevention, downtown development, fire protection, and more. Total property tax collections in the state rocketed from about $12.76 billion in 2022 to $15.45 billion in 2023. Cuts through the legislature trimmed that amount slightly to $15.29 billion in 2024. Schools reaped more than half the total collections in recent years. The seeming windfall, however, was only enough to keep up with delayed maintenance and upgrades, along with the rising costs for people and equipment that nearly every organization faced, officials with the district said. All the changes to tax rates equal a savings of about $270 for the owner of a $625,000 home on next year's tax bill versus the taxes they would have owed under pre-2021 tax rates, according to the state's Department of Local Affairs. The department expects the savings to rise to $300 for a similar home in tax year 2026, paid in 2027. Overall, the cuts between 2021 and 2024 have lowered tax bills by more than $800 million in the aggregate, a figure that's expected to exceed $1 billion total in the coming year. Quote, I'm proud of Colorado's work to reduce property taxes for Coloradans, helping people stay in their homes and keeping more of their hard-earned money, Governor Jared Polis said in a statement. This has been a bipartisan effort that has saved hundreds of millions of dollars for Coloradans, unquote. Combating rising tax burdens. The Common Sense Institute, a business-oriented think tank based in Greenwood Village, has regularly found Colorado in last place or near last place in housing affordability, Executive Director Kelly Caulfield said in an interview. Between 2016 and 2023, households in Denver saw their overall tax burden between state, local, and federal obligations rise by more than 50%, she said. The overall effect of the property tax cuts hasn't yet become clear and will require more data to suss out. But, she noted, the legislature focused on cutting the rates at a time of acute sticker shock. At the time, Coloradans were seeing their property values rise by 33% or more, with a corresponding rise in their tax bills. Quote, there are a lot of things to unpack still, Caulfield said, but I think things are still feeling better for a lot of Coloradans than they did when we were in that crisis moment of huge increases, unquote. In 2020, voters repealed the Gallagher Amendment in the state constitution, which locked in a certain ratio of residential to commercial property taxes that provided extra security for homeowners against sudden increases. The vote, in effect, unmoored residential property taxes right when home values surged at a historic pace, leaving owners gobsmacked by bills that reflected their new valuations. Over the next several years, lawmakers tweaked the property tax formula to make it more palatable, while also trying to avoid more dramatic cuts that outside advocacy groups were proposing for the ballot, and which officials worried would slash local services. The efforts to wrestle down property taxes led to multiple special sessions of the state legislature, a failed referred ballot measure, and regular end-of-session bills to wrench down tax rates. The most recent deal, passed during a 2024 special session of the legislature, included a 6-year moratorium on new property tax measures from either the legislature or from backers of proposed but ultimately rescinded ballot measures that would have ratcheted down the tax formula even further. That law changed the formula used by the state to determine a property's assessed value or the amount of the value that's subject to taxation to provide tax relief. And it limited how much local property tax collections could grow. While the state determines the assessment rate, property taxes are fundamentally a local concern. Local voters vote on local government's mill levies, which are the percentage of their assessed value that is taxed for local services. The web of special districts can mean homes in the same city, but located just blocks apart, can pay slightly different rates for different services. The state's changes to the rates chafed some local districts' officials, including fire districts that fretted about affording equipment and firefighters as risks from wildfires loomed large year-round. Quote, "Just the cost of providing services and buying equipment has increased astronomically," said Ken Watkins, the executive director of the Colorado State Fire Chiefs, which represents fire districts throughout the state. Tax rate changes affect planning. Fire trucks alone have doubled in cost since the pandemic, with a price tag of up to $2 million for a ladder truck, he said. "The constant tweaking of the property tax rates has wreaked havoc with future planning," Watkins said. The changes also led districts to scramble to avoid cutting essential services. That has included some districts cutting back specialist medical response teams, mental health crisis teams, and heavy rescue teams, Watkins said. Others have tried to use another state law from 2024 that allowed them to ask local voters to raise sales taxes or the fees charged to developers to service new neighborhoods or businesses. Fire departments are made up of Coloradans who are also feeling the pinch from higher costs, Watkins said. They're often hesitant to stick their hands out to neighbors who are likewise struggling, but many districts are facing cuts of 15% or more to their projected revenue, potentially millions of dollars in larger districts, because of changes to property tax law. By his tally, 39 districts asked for some kind of relief in 2025, including raising mill levies or asking voters to uncap revenue collection. In some cases, that meant asking voters to approve tax increases they had already voted on in prior elections because the new law essentially overrode those prior votes. 9 were successful. Quote, "There are solutions for sure by going to your voters, but we don't like to go to voters unless we really have to," Watkins said. "Certainly, we realize taxes are an issue for everyone in Colorado. We're not saying we're not concerned, because our citizens are paying more in taxes just like we are." Unquote. Ultimately, local property taxes are determined by local need, said Terry from the Special District Association. State officials stepping into the debate meant decisions in the Capitol were superseding decisions made by local governments. Quote, "Special districts are frustrated that the legislature removed any prior voter-approved approval of their revenue limits," Terry said, referring to local votes to remove growth caps. "It feels like a real disregard for local government elections and voter intent," unquote. But she and others won't know exactly how the cuts' impacts will trickle into local communities until the changes have settled for another year or two and budgets have adjusted to the recently cooling housing market. And now, also from today's front page, our final main article, Catalyst. Study says the project could drive $2.9 billion in economic activity. No on 1A, a Greeley Forward coalition in favor of the Catalyst project, warns that delays could endanger 5,200 new jobs. Written by Tyler Duncan of Prairie Mountain Media. There is a photo accompanying this article with a caption reading, "Greeley Mayor Dale Hall speaks during a press conference by Greeley Forward, asking voters to vote no on ballot proposal 1A outside of the Greeley Ice House in Greeley on Monday." Mayor Hall is pictured at a podium, and behind him is an array of people all holding signs that read, "No on 1A." Here's the article. The Catalyst Project in West Greeley could drive $2.9 billion in economic activity over 10 years, creating 1,385 jobs per year, according to a new study released on Monday. No on 1A, a Greeley Forward coalition in favor of the project, released an economic impact study performed by Hotel and Leisure Advisors at a news conference Monday outside the Greeley Ice House, located at 900 8th Avenue. The Catalyst Project is set to include a hotel, water park, and arena for the Colorado Eagles hockey team in West Greeley. The city estimates the project will cost $832 million, which includes design, construction, infrastructure, and utilities. A special election on February 24th will allow voters to decide whether to repeal the project's zoning, which could delay the project by a year if passed. The Greeley Demands Better Issue Committee, which considers the project too risky, petitioned for the special election in a bid to freeze the project. Quote, ballot measure 1A would only temporarily overturn the previously approved zoning designations for the site. It would not stop or prevent Cascadia, and the developer can reapply for zoning approval, Greeley Forward spokesman Tom Donkel said Monday. These opportunities are simply too big to let slip through Greeley's fingers, unquote. The study, provided to the city on November 3rd and obtained under the Colorado Open Records Act by Greeley Forward, estimates the Catalyst Project will have a combined economic impact of $2.92 billion over the first 10 years, creating 1,385 jobs annually once built. Over 30 years, the project will generate $459 million in tax revenue for the city, according to the study. It also estimates the project will create 3,800 construction-related jobs. Quote, the economic analysis that Greeley Forward has shared is projecting $292 billion of total economic impact over the first 10 years alone. In other words, Cascadia is going to make it possible for Greeley to strengthen public services that people rely on every day, Weld County Commissioner Kevin Ross said. Delaying this project in any way would create real harm. Thousands of jobs would be unnecessarily delayed by a year or more, and local businesses and restaurants would lose out on all the spending and the new customers that would potentially be coming downtown during the construction phase, unquote. Several Greeley officials showed their support of the project Monday, including Mayor Dale Hall, Mayor Pro Tem Melissa McDonald, and former Mayor John Gates, as well as other city council members. They all shared the same message. Voting to repeal the zoning would only delay the project and endanger Greeley's future. Quote, Cascadia is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to create thousands of good-paying jobs and generate hundreds of millions of dollars in new tax revenues that can be reinvested back into our community, Hall said. To unnecessarily delay this project risks thousands of good-paying jobs and also prevents us from fixing Highway 34, unquote. Other city council members at the news conference echoed Hall's concerns, with McDonald adding the city will retain ownership of the entertainment district. The city will be able to use it to host more than 200 concerts, games, and special events each year, she said. Any delays in this project will disrupt the city's plans to repay the certificates of participation used to fund pre-development, which are on track to be paid off by the end of the year, Gates said. Quote, 1A would be disastrous to the city of Greeley if passed. There's been a lot of controversy over this project, and a lot of that has been caused by misunderstandings and misinformation about the $115 million in certificates of participation used to kickstart the financing in Cascadia, Gates said. I want to be clear. A yes vote injects malicious uncertainty into a financing structure that is currently stable and performing as intended, unquote. The land surrounding the Catalyst Project will draw increased interest from developers seeking to build residential and commercial projects, according to the study, which also projects increased usage of existing restaurants, hotel, retail, and other commercial establishments in the city. The development is also expected to raise property values in the immediate neighborhood. Quote, the development of the proposed project will positively influence the city of Greeley and the overall neighborhood surrounding the subject. The subject resort and arena will add to the list of attractions Greeley has to offer, the study says. We accounted for this influence in the previous projections, which indicate the direct and indirect impact from visitor spending, both at the subject and in the surrounding area, unquote. After listing similar indoor water park resorts that received government assistance across the U.S., the study's authors say the risks associated with the development justify such assistance. Hotel and Leisure Advisors also conducted the feasibility study released by the Greeley Demands Better Issue Committee in late December. That study warned the project's debt service, estimated at $41.5 million annually, cannot be covered by the city's proposed revenue sources in the first 9 to 16 years. But it also noted that the quote-unquote broader context should be considered, including additional revenues from surrounding commercial and residential activity that could offset that gap. The economic impact study similarly mentioned its own limitations, noting that the estimated results are based on quote-unquote efficient management of the water park, resort, and arena, as well as, quote, an aggressive marketing program, unquote. Quote, as in all studies of this type, the conclusions reached do not consider or provide for the effect of any sharp rise or decline in local or general economic conditions not presently foreseeable, the study says. The city, which ordered both studies, said in December there were four studies it had commissioned and that one alone would not show the full picture. Greeley Forward Representative Bill Rigler said the economic impact study, along with the feasibility study, will be officially published on Friday and will be discussed at the City Council meeting on January 13th. Greeley Demands Better representatives were unavailable to provide a comment before the article's deadline. Greeley Forward has published the drafts of both Hotel and Leisure Advisor studies at greeleyforward.com. We will finish our time today with miscellaneous articles, beginning with the Greeley Tribune obituary tributes for Wednesday, January 7th. Gregorio Muro, age 85, passed away on December 17th at his home in Alt. A celebration of life will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 10th, at Journey Christian Church, which is located at 4754 West 31st Street in Greeley. Kenneth Lindblad was born April 22, 1946, to George and Eileen Lindblad in Greeley. He passed away December 28th after a short battle with pancreatic cancer. He grew up on the family farm and attended Severance Elementary and Windsor Middle and High Schools. After graduation, he attended Northwestern Junior College, graduating in 1966. In 1967, Ken married Eileen Reed in Greeley, and shortly after served in the Navy Reserves for 6 years. He then worked for IBM in Longmont for 3 years and retired from Eastman Kodak after 32 years. His family writes that in his spare time and after retirement, Ken loved working on and restoring antique cars and gas engines and anything that needed fixing. His love for old cars led him to belong to several antique car clubs, including the Horseless Carriage Club and the Poudre Valley Antique Auto Club. He is survived by his wife, Eileen, children Corey Lindblad and wife Jennifer, and Dina Carlson and husband Barry. He is also survived by 3 grandchildren, his brothers Sam and Carl, his sister Ruth Roberts and her family, and several nieces and nephews. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, January 9th at Timberline Church, located at 2908 South Timberline Road in Fort Collins. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to one of Ken's favorite charities, the Wounded Warrior Project. Robert G. Toynton, affectionately known as Bob, passed away peacefully on December 27th in his home, surrounded by family and in the care of hospice. He was 92 years old. Bob was born May 19, 1933, in Smith Center, Kansas, the eldest child of Glenn and Dorothy Toynton. After graduating from Almena High School in Kansas, Bob's life took a pivotal turn when a friend encouraged him to pursue higher education. With this encouragement and his own aspirations, he enrolled at Kansas State University, embarking on what would become a transformative chapter in his life. At Kansas State, Bob chose to study civil engineering, a field that would shape his future in profound ways. During his senior year at K-State, Bob interviewed Betty Bramall to run on a political ticket as senior class secretary. Betty ended up as the love of his life. Their connection blossomed into a partnership that exemplified mutual respect, shared dreams, and unwavering support. The two married and built a life centered on community, ambition, and family. Their enduring partnership became a cornerstone of Bob's life, continuing until Betty's passing in 2020, leaving a legacy of love and dedication that touched many. Bob dedicated his life to improving communities, often working with Betty on projects. His leadership greatly impacted Greeley through support for education, infrastructure, and civic engagement. His generosity funded scholarships and programs to improve education. Bob believed in education's transformative power since college. The family foundation he and Betty created continues to contribute to civic projects, education, and scholarships, aiming to sustain these efforts for generations. Bob and Betty had a passion for downtown Greeley. They believed that the heart of any community was its downtown core and worked tirelessly to help make the downtown district of Greeley the thriving area it is now. Bob was involved in the Downtown Development Authority for over 30 years. He also purchased and renovated many buildings in downtown to accelerate the transformation. Bob and Betty were big supporters of education in their hometown of Greeley. They started the Student Recovery Program in 2007, which helps mentor male Latino high school students who are behind on credits and helps them complete high school. They invested in the Blended Learning Pilot Program at Bella Romero Academy. They were strong supporters of numerous mill levy overrides and bond issues over the years. As a result of their lifelong commitment to Greeley Evans School District 6, a newly constructed school in 2022 was named the Twinton Academy of Pre-Engineering. Bob and Betty created the Twinton Institute for Educational Change at the University of Northern Colorado in 1995. This program was designed to provide K-12 educators with the opportunity to become better leaders. For over 30 years, the program has worked with more than 1,410 principals, 425 school teams, and 3,600 teacher leaders in Colorado. The Institute has impacted the lives of hundreds of thousands of school children throughout Colorado and continues to operate with the same purpose today. Bob is survived by his brother, Roger, and his wife, Sherry, son, Bill, and wife, Janie Jill, son, Brian, and wife, Judy, four grandchildren, three great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandson. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to any of the following charitable organizations: the UNC Foundation for the Twinton Institute for Educational Change, the Betty L. Twinton Fund at the Weld Community Foundation, or the Twinton Family Foundation. There will be a private graveside service for Bob. A joint celebration of life for both Bob and Betty will be held at a future date. An announcement will be made as soon as details become available. The following death notices are also published in today's paper. Raymond Jacoby of Fort Collins, age 94, passed away December 7th. Services are scheduled for January 9th, 11 a.m. at Faith Church of Windsor. Burial will follow at the Lakeview Cemetery in Windsor. Roy Elias Melendez Zavala has passed away. A celebration occurred today at 11 a.m. at Mosaic Church in Evans. Philip Sloan of Greeley. A life celebration is scheduled for Friday, January 9th, 2 p.m. at Adamson Life Celebration Home. And now to today's editorial page. Today we have a Views from the Nation's Press column, an editorial from the Denver Post, and we have two new letters to the editor. As with all articles and letters on the editorial page, the content I am about to read is directly from the source material and does not represent my personal views or those of AfterSight. First, Views from the Nation's Press, from the Denver Post editorial board, on how Colorado needs calm leadership in the face of a vengeful president. Here's the editorial. President Donald Trump would like Coloradans to know this holiday season that he wants our governor to, quote, rot in hell, unquote, and that he wishes Mesa County's district attorney, Dan Rubenstein, quote, only the worst, unquote. All that anger directed at Coloradans is because our justice system is refusing to release a woman who was tried and convicted of fraud in relation to Trump's illegal attempt to remain in office in 2020. Trump's embarrassing temper tantrums would be tolerable if they didn't also come with real-world actions that hurt Coloradans, costing them their livelihoods and, yes, access to clean drinking water. Governor Jared Polis and Representative Lauren Boebert's responses to Trump give us hope that Americans can unite after Trump leaves office, as required by the U.S. Constitution, in January 2029. Trump will not succeed in his effort to divide Coloradans who love one another despite our political differences. Trump is hurting our more liberal-minded residents in Boulder County with his decisions to first cut dozens of jobs at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and then his pledge to dismantle the headquarters entirely. And now Trump will hurt more conservative-minded Coloradans with his veto of $1.2 billion in federal funding for a clean drinking water pipeline to residents in eastern Pueblo County, who have been advised for years not to drink well water because of contamination. Before the new year, Trump ordered his administration to move the work at the National Center for Atmospheric Research from Boulder to, quote, another entity or location, unquote. The administration attempted to blame the move on NCAR's work studying climate change. The White House issued a statement to the Denver Post calling NCAR, quote, the premier research stronghold for left-wing climate lunacy, unquote. We disagree strongly with both of the assertions in that statement. First, the global climate is warming, and a vast amount of scientific research indicates that the trend is being driven in large part by the increase in greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, among others, in our atmosphere. Second, NCAR's work is professional, scientifically based, and doesn't carry a hint of the quote-unquote alarmism that we see from many politicians who talk about an extinction-level event occurring in a few years. But we also don't believe for a moment that, quote, climate change alarmism, unquote, is the real reason behind Trump's decision to dismantle NCAR, a federal agency we must remind the president that was created by Congress and funded by Congress and protected from unilateral termination by the executive branch. Trump's decision came rapidly after Colorado officials refused Trump's demand that Tina Peters be released from jail. Peters, a former clerk and recorder from Mesa County, was convicted of using fraudulent means to give a random man access to the county's voting equipment. Peters believed Trump's lies that the 2020 election had been stolen. She stole credentials from one of her employees and brought a man into a secure area where he accessed data from vote counting machines. Later, she tried to cover up her actions. The data did not show any evidence of voter fraud. But that has not prevented Trump from trying to pardon her, and now from retaliating against Colorado officials who are merely upholding the work of a jury of Peter's peers who found her guilty. Hundreds of federal workers in Colorado have already lost their jobs as a result of Trump's policies. Then those employees who remained suffered under the federal shutdown. Now Trump is coming again for federal workers, claiming he is trying to reduce the federal debt and deficit. But Trump's one big beautiful bill added more to the federal deficit than what he has cut so far. Which brings us to Trump's most recent retaliatory action against Colorado, which he says was done in the name of cutting the federal budget and, quote, restoring fiscal sanity, unquote. We cannot argue with Trump that the $1.3 billion price tag to bring clean drinking water to 50,000 residents is steep, but it is not wasteful. This is a necessary and long-awaited public infrastructure project. The project has been thoroughly vetted and is shovel-ready. Trump's veto is a black eye on his administration, and his outlandish words and actions only underline why he is wholly unfit to serve as President of the United States of America. That guest editorial was from the editorial board of the Denver Post. And now we have two new letters to the editor. The first is from Eleanor of Greeley. In response to A letter from Hunter Rivera of December 10th, entitled Representative Gabe Evans is a Colorado Energy Champion. Mr. Rivera presents, quote, all of the above energy, unquote, as common sense, but it's not. It hides the same old carbon-polluting fossil fuels behind cleaner forms of energy. He says using all forms of energy lowers costs, but it doesn't. Solar and wind power are cheaper than fossil fuels. He favors both and over either or. But some forms of energy kill. Roughly 800 Coloradans die each year from air pollution worsened by fossil fuel emissions. I'd rather choose energy development that reduces high ozone days along the Front Range. He wants to remove quote-unquote barriers to energy development, but those barriers protect low-income communities, endangered species, cherished landscapes. They allow for the public to decide whether they want, say, a data center next door. One more quote-unquote but. Mr. Rivera leads the Colorado chapter of the American Conservation Coalition, an organization for politically conservative environmentalists. We likely disagree on much, but we agree on a lot, too. For instance, we agree we shouldn't pick winners and losers. That means asking our congressional representatives to pass the SPEED Act only if offshore wind is again included in permitting reform. That letter was from Eleanor of Greeley. And our second letter is from Ron of Greeley. Can President Trump free Tina Peters? The easy answer is no. Tina Peters was the former Mesa County clerk who was convicted in August 2023 in the Grand Junction courtroom. She did this by breaching the Mesa County's voting machines and election system. She was sentenced to 9 years in Colorado State Prison. Since her conviction was in Colorado State Courts, President Trump has no jurisdiction in a state's judicial system to grant her a pardon. Still, President Trump wants her pardoned. Why? After over 5 years, he continues to rail that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from him. He has pardoned 1,600 January 6th insurrectionists who invaded the U.S. Capitol, trying to overturn the election results, injuring or killing police in the process. He's either fired or threatened any attorneys who tried to prosecute him. Tina Peters is probably one of the few 2020 election deniers who he hasn't pardoned. Now he has belittled Governor Polis, calling him a scumbag governor, and, quote, may he rot in hell, unquote. He has vetoed funds for a much-needed clean water project for Las Animas and southeast Colorado that was over 50% completed and approved by Congress in 2023. Of interest is the people who will benefit from this basic human need overwhelmingly voted for President Trump in the 2024 election. Who knows what President Trump will try next to punish the people of Colorado? It's obvious Mr. Trump doesn't like to lose by his actions. I don't like to lose either. Still, at some point one has to say, enough is enough, and move on. President Trump, and the remainder of this sentence is in all capital letters, you lost the 2020 presidential election. Give it a rest. That letter was from Ron of Greeley. And now back to local news. The Greeley Stampede will have a new weapons detection system at this year's event to keep attendees safe while keeping up with industry standards. Event attendance has exceeded 300,000 people for the past 4 years, according to a Greeley Stampede news release, and the Stampede will work with the Weld County Sheriff's Office and the Greeley Police on the system to prevent illegal and prohibited weapons from entering the premises. The weapons detection system is a contactless system that guests will walk through. It uses artificial intelligence to analyze the shape and density of guests' items to distinguish car keys and phones from items that could pose a threat. The Stampede will continue to allow lawful concealed carry handguns that meet state regulations, as the system is set up to not allow illegal weapons from entering, such as open carry firearms or weapons that are concealed without a concealed carry permit. Those with a concealed carry handgun owner permit must also show their permit before entering the area. Quote, most won't even know that they've walked through it, unlike a traditional metal detector, Greeley Stampede Security Chairman John Patton said in a news release. If the system sounds an alert, guests will be asked to walk through it again and participate in further screening if needed. The system is a proactive measure, according to the news release, and helps the Stampede meet safety standards seen at other events of a similar size, like Elitch Gardens Amusement Park or at Empower Field Stadium events. The weapons detection system is in addition to the Stampede's clear bag policy, as the system does not detect other prohibited items like outside beverages or fireworks. The clear bag policy was updated in 2024 to require guests to place personal items in a clear bag or in a small bag for entry into any Stampede event. Backpacks and large purses are not allowed into the Stampede, with the exception of medical equipment. The 2026 Greeley Stampede will run from June 24th to July 5th. A woman died Monday after she was struck by two vehicles while attempting to cross U.S. 34. Greeley police arrived at the crash at 5:50 p.m. Monday, according to a Greeley Police Department news release. Initial investigations show that a 19-year-old woman tried to cross U.S. 34 in the 5500 block in an unmarked area with no crosswalk, where she was struck by a Chevrolet Blazer on the driver's side, driven by a 54-year-old man. The impact sent her into the inside lane of traffic, where she was struck by a Chevrolet Traverse, driven by a 37-year-old woman. The woman was taken to North Colorado Medical Center, where she was pronounced dead. Her name will be released by the Weld County Coroner's Office following notification of next of kin. Neither of the drivers was injured, and no charges against them are anticipated, according to the news release. A witness to the crash told police they saw the woman cross the street as traffic arrived. No further details will be released just yet. Anyone with information on the crash can contact Officer Ed Kubala at edward.kubala@greeleypd.com. That's edward.kubala@greeleypd.com. Drivers should expect delays along 23rd Avenue in North Greeley for the next several weeks. Construction at the intersection of 23rd Avenue and 5th Street will heavily impact traffic, according to a Greeley Police Department Facebook post. From 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., drivers will see lanes reduced to one lane in each direction. Drivers are advised to use alternate roads or plan for delays. The city is replacing the current bridge structure at the intersection, according to City Public Information Officer Kim Kappel. The project is estimated to take about 2 months. City staff are finalizing traffic management plans, which include full road closures during some parts of construction. Information will be made available 2 weeks before any road closures, according to the city. The city has been planning to improve the intersection since 2023, according to the city's engagement website, Speak Up Greeley. The improvements are set to include better designs for walking, biking, and driving, as well as new landscaping and artwork. The last major reconstruction of the intersection was in the 1970s, according to the city. Officials hope the changes will create a safer and more appealing space. And now, announcements of a couple of concerts coming up this weekend at the Moxie. This Friday at 7, the Moxie Theater at 802 9th Street will host a concert by William Clark Green with the Eli Ray Band. William Clark Green is a Texas-born singer-songwriter known for his raw, honest songwriting and electrifying live shows. This Flint, Texas native brings 50 years of storytelling through song to the stage. Then on Saturday night at 7, the Moxie will feature a concert by Dave Wimbish of The Collection. After 4 albums and countless shows with his band The Collection, Dave Wimbish returns to his origins with the onset of his new incarnation as a solo artist. Please phone the Moxie at 970-584-3054. For ticket information for either of these shows, that number again is 970-584-3054. And finally today, the 5-day weather forecast for the Greeley area. Times of sun and clouds today, a high of 58. A bit of a change overnight, a low of 31 and some ice falling late in the evening. Thursday's high 40, a little snow in the afternoon. Low overnight Thursday of 23. Friday, a little morning snow and windy, a high of 34, a low Friday night of 12. Saturday, mostly sunny and not as cold, a high of 45, a low of 11 Saturday night. Sunday, sunshine and some clouds, a high of 49. Thank you for joining us for the Greeley Tribune, read by Alisa Burrows.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Greeley Tribune, please contact them directly at letters@greeleytribune.com or call 970-352-0211.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.